This is the Fisher Body Historical Team. Today is Monday, February 27th, 2006. It's approximately 12:30 p.m. We're preparing to interview Mike McAvoy. First, let's introduce the team.
John Fedewa.
Gary Judy.
Earl Nicholson.
Jerry Smith.
And this is Cheryl McQuaid. Mike, would you please state your name and spell it for us, please?
So, Mike McAvoy, M-I-K-E-B-O-K-O-V-O-Y.
And could you tell us what your address is?
3616 West St. Joseph Street, Lansing, Michigan.
And are you married? Do you have children?
Yes, I am. I'm married. I have three of my own and one stepson. Ranges in age from 32 to 23.
And could you tell us a little bit about your education? Where did you go to school, if you've been to college?
I graduated from high school, Waverly, in the year 1974. I had 2 years of college, at 2.5 years of college at Lansing Community, and then I didn't finish.
Where were you born?
Lansing, Michigan, Sparrow Hospital.
And what did your parents do?
My mom was a housewife, and my father was factory. He worked at Fisher Body also.
What did you do before you hired into Fisher Body? Did you just get out of college?
I went out of high school. I went into, I was a wrestling coach up north, and then I went and I was a ASC certified mechanic at a garage, and then I wanted to better myself, so I went and hired in GM.
What brought you to GM?
Well, basically, the life that I saw, it gave my grandfather and my dad, I guess, and I don't know, probably the money and the hours, you know. A lot of my friends were going in, so I kind of seen what they were doing, so then I took a chance at it.
Do you remember what your grandfather did in the plant?
Yep, he was a material sorter. He was a, I don't know, he put in about almost 32 years. His name was Mike also. But he didn't like talk a lot about what he did. I mean, even at home. I mean, he made, even if it was a big garden area or whatever. But the only thing I ever got out of him was he took and told me about checking leather before, where to see if it had any insect bites or if it had any barbed wire marks or stuff like that, where they used to make seats out of him when he checked in leather pelts and stuff. That's about the only thing I really got out of him about it. And then, of course, my dad worked in material, too, so.
And did you get any stories from your father about
that? Oh, there's quite a few from my dad. I mean, I could probably talk a ton about it. I do know what he told me the first job he had. It was kind of funny. He hired in on a Valentine's Day. I think it was 1946, I think. And he told me his first job was he had to grab a rope, he had to pull the job up an incline, and after it got up to the top, he had to put a door jam on it. And that was every job. And the only reason why he came in there was because my grandpa forced him. Finally told him, well, if you're not going to go to college or whatever, you got a couple weeks to get a job. And so the next thing you know, of course, my dad didn't get a job or he didn't go to school. So the next thing you know, he was hired in a shop. So that's basically how that happened. And then, well, I don't know, I guess it was probably about 65 or something like that when grandpa went out. And then my dad retired in 81, so I don't know, I guess you had it all up. It was almost 35 years for him. So then I came in 76, which I'm still there now. But I put in all my time in body shop. So, but I, of course, I seen my dad. I used to work, I worked for him a couple of times. That was fun. That was real fun. But then he did miscellaneous jobs. He was anywhere from a laborer, I guess, in material, to being a foreman, to being a superintendent, to back to being a salvage coordinator, I think is what his job was, the last one before he left.
How old were you when you hired him?
I was 19. Just going to turn 20. I was on the end of 19.
Do you remember the whole hiring process? Do you think your father helped you get a job there?
Well, at first he told me when I first got the application, I bugged him for a little while about it because, like I said, some of my friends went in. And then he goes, well, I don't really know. And he brought me home. It was a card is what it was. And he filled it all out and went in. And heck, it wasn't even 2 days and I got a call. And I remember the interview really well. Guy was Jerry Brooks. And it was upstairs in the back of the cafeteria where we used to have our team room in there for EPG, a play involvement. And I still remember it. They went through an orientation. They told you had to have boots. You had to have, they had to be leather boots. And depending on where you went. And then side shields and all that type of deal and coveralls. It was kind of a quick process. And as soon as they got all done, they wanted to know if he wanted to go to work right away. But I didn't go right in because I liked my boss where I was at. So I gave him a couple weeks notice. And I was supposed to hire in Cushion Room. And that was Dave's Cushion Room, and I told him I couldn't do it, so they put me in on nights in body shop. So I was working over at the gas station being a mechanic during the day, and then I was going in a Fisher Body at nights. And I did that for about 3.5 months. And, of course, the next thing you know, we had all them Saturdays and the 9-4s and 10-3s and all that type of deal. And then I just, I couldn't handle it anymore. My other boss, he wouldn't find anybody, so I finally just said, adios, I got to go, I got to get some rest and stuff like that.
Do you remember the first day that you walked in there and they took you to the body shop?
Yeah, I do. I still remember the guy's name, too. His name was, I think it was Tom Lee, and he was a pretty big, I think he was a general foreman back then, I think. I know his last name was Lee. And he took me down through the body shop, and I mean there was conveyors all up in the air. They were all over the place, and everything was really tight, and it was dirty, it was smoky, it was hot. And I'm like, the very first thing I'm seeing myself, of course, I'm only, almost 20 years old, and I was walking through there, and I used to always work outside being, mechanic, and I was always outside guy, and I was like, oh my God, man, what did I get myself into here? And he's walking me from department to department, and I bet we talked to probably about 3 different people, and I don't really I couldn't understand that. I guess in today's world, if they had an extra body, man, they'd latch right on to you in a minute, but back then, I just kept going, and then I ended up going in underbody, and I stayed in underbody for a long time. My first boss was Mike Myers and Joe Shane. And Joe Shane, he ended up eventually being a general foreman throughout the years, and stuff. But I worked for Joe in a lot of different aspects, when he was a first-line boss and then all the way up. I stayed in underbody for quite a while. Remember the first job I ever had, too? It was welding the trunk and the floor pan together. Is what we used to call a kick-up weld. You used to have to weld your half, plus weld the seat back on, which held the back seat in. And then you had to put a filler on, and what it did is it went to the underbody on the rear pan that closed into the side frame, and you had to seal that and seal around the back side. And that was on the 88s and 98s, and then if there was a tornado coming, you had to really hurry to catch the tornado. And that had about 3 spot welders and a MIG welder on it, which MIG welders like arc welding. And you used to have to arc weld a seat bracket down on the floor pan. And then you had to put the seat back on. And you also had this great big spot welder that welded the front cowl area to the floor pan. And every single tornado job was hot. I mean, they were just, the steel was huge. And it was tough. It was real tough. And then after you got rid of the tornado, you had to hurry up because you had an 88 or 98 behind it. So you either had to work hard to get to the tornado and then work hard after you got back to get to the 88 or 98 afterwards. I can't remember how many an hour. I got to try to remember. I think it was maybe about 36 an hour. But still, when you had about 4 spot welders on the job plus sealer and stuff, you were moving pretty good.
So did you consider it a physical job?
Yeah, it was hot. You had to be up and down on the buttons and on the spot welders. You had to open and close, and then you had high heat and low heat trigger, location, and it seemed like every spot welder too on a tornado was always about 6 times the size of the ones for the 898. I don't know if it was an ergonomic thing or whatever, I mean, or actually, no, I can't even say ergonomics because there wasn't any ergonomics back then. But maybe it was just the way they could get it in to do the welding, I guess. I don't know, but they were huge. And he had a lot of them, he had to really manhandle them and stuff to get them around. He didn't build a million tornadoes, thank God, but I'll tell you, it was back in the old body shop days, it was really smoky. You could come in, you just seen a haze up in the air. And you knew right then and there it wasn't any air for the night, so it was going to be hot more as your time got in. And then, like I said, I don't know, I worked on a line for, I don't know, it wasn't even three months. I didn't have my 90 days in, and I went on utility. And I worked utility for a long, long time. It's kind of an undesirable job. And I actually got bumped to days. And out of my 30 years, I didn't work very much nights. A guy bumped me off utility on nights and bumped me to days. And I think maybe I had a couple, three stints at nights. But it just wasn't a job that people liked to do. It was when somebody didn't come in, or if they had a vacation day, or if they got hurt, or whatever. But you're just kind of like an extra board person. And I liked it because I didn't have to do the same job every day. That's what I really did. I liked that. And I went on and, I went from utility to relief. I used to run relief until they went to mass relief. Then I went into, I did relief quite a while before I became a team coordinator. And I was a team coordinator for about 7 years before Delta went.
Do you remember some of the people that you worked around when you first hired in?
Yeah, I still do.
And who taught you the job?
Wasn't the intermittent man. It was usually an extra guy. The intermittent man was his job, was just to be around for emergency purposes. They didn't work them. They never did. It was just something that happened then. I don't know. It was totally different than what it is now. But I remember, but it didn't take me very long either to learn a job. Everybody kept telling me I had 3 days to learn a job, but it didn't take me that long. And once they knew you were halfway decent, I don't know, it just seems like everything was kind of pushed through a little bit. Still know the guy today that was across from me. His name was Dan McDonald. He lives up in Ionia. And he's been retired now for probably about 9 years, 8, 9 years. The guy I'm working with still is Terry Socher. He was a utility guy when I hired in on a job. They had him on utility because he only had about 2 weeks on me, so they were apparently looking for utility people, somebody that knew how to run a lot of jobs. And then where I remember John Lilly, Frank Ash. John Lilly was intermittent man. Frank Ash was relief man. Oh, gosh, ton of guys. Bancroft. I mean, I remember a lot of them guys because I worked with them for years.
Was it hard to communicate with them? I've always heard the body shop was a noisy place.
It was loud, but you just spoke up. Sometimes you had to repeat yourself. Everything was, it was loud because it was all packed. It was really packed, and it was crowded, dirty, and hot. That's about all I can say. And you look forward to that every day. I mean, that's just the way it was. There was so much sealer. There was also lead paint and everything else. But there was always so much sealer on a job that if you didn't throw floor dry down, your feet got so heavy by lunchtime that and you couldn't stand it anymore. It just filled the whole bottom of your feet up. So you put floor dry down and it kind of ate it off your feet. And it would just not stick to it. And then next thing you know, you can move around.
Ate what off your feet?
The sealer, well, what it was called red eye, and I'll tell you, that stuff was amazing. I found it in my apartment one time, sitting on the couch, and I looked down, and it was on my carpet, and I always took my shoes off, but that was just how that stuff was. You got it on you, it was on your lunch, it was all over you. It was a red sear that you put, and it was a common use thing back then, Man, I don't know. It just would get all over him. I guess it was almost like the purple stuff up in paint that was in, Lancey Carr or somebody before we left.
So it was kind of like a putty type stuff?
Yeah, well, best I could say is it kind of looked like a red stuff that you would cock out of a gun or whatever, kind of had an oily substance to it. They nicknamed her Red Eye, and that was just what it was. It was nasty stuff. It was terrible.
Now, did you work in the jungle?
Worked all over. At one time, I don't know if I should really brag this up or what. I don't know. Everybody's told me about it because there wasn't too many guys that could do it. But at one time on the Cutlass line, 80-90 Tornado line, I knew every single job in both body shops. And except for solder, I didn't go in the solder booths very much. I only went in a few times grinding and finishing it. I had never really worked the torch and flowed all the solder in and stuff like that. But that was an art. That was one heck of an art. There was a lot of guys that were in there that really you had to know what you were doing, because on some of them jobs, especially the Tornado would be coming, and then if there was a 98 come behind it, they had a great big, what they call was a quarter sail, and if it didn't have a vinyl top, which back then the option was CO4, if it had solder, it would take two solder pots to fill that up, not just one like an 88 would or whatever, or doing the front poles would only take maybe about half a pot. So you'd have to kind of look up the line, and then you'd have to have somebody help you, because you'd have to put all the solder rods in, and it was a job to learn. And I never really got in there. I mean, I did it a little bit with a guy one time, and then the guy come in late, and then I kind of went down the end, and that was just like a grinder and a sander on it. But you used to have to wear a hood in there, and then they used to monitor you. Well, they said they monitored you, but it wasn't a whole lot, but they would monitor you for lead content. You'd go down and get your blood taken, and if you were subsessed to it too much, then you had too much lead inside your blood, and then you kind of had to go to another job for a while until it kind of went away from you. No women were allowed in there. That was a heck of an area there. I don't know. There were just certain people that they had that went in there. Like I said, I started in underbody. I worked a lot in what they called body framing back then. It was where the two side frames came in. I worked in side frames. And then they welded the body together. And then they went into a jungle area. The reason why they called it a jungle is because there were so many cables hanging that it just reminded you of being in a jungle, like a whole bunch of vines. And they were all attached to welders, anywhere from seam welders to gusset welders to door openings, rollers. I mean, it was unbelievable. There must have been, man, I don't know, I got to say 60 probably or more welders on each side of the line. So you can imagine with all the transformers hanging in the air and all on cables and balancers and guns. It was a big, big area. Then I went into the art booth, and that's where they did brazing, and then did a bunch of arc welding inside of the job and in long spots where they didn't pick up with spot welds or whatever, or they couldn't get a gun in. There was a whole bunch of mid welds. That kind of eventually went away as we started building different cars, but there was a period of time where arc booth was a pretty big area. There must have been about seven guys on each side welding. And of course, the dash job, that was a MIG weld job where you had to put in a steering column and a radio bracket. I can still remember that job. That was a hot job, a hot, fast job. You used to get burned up all the time. Sparks flying, and you used to have to wear a weld hat and weld gloves, or you'd end up getting pretty well scorched on that. Body shop was just I don't know. To stay there for 30 years, it's something. It really is. Some people just, they'd be down there for a few years and they just couldn't handle it. They just says, I'm out of here. And they were going to either go to paint or they were going to trim or something. But I liked it. Heck, especially since I could be on days. I mean, I've seen so many people wandering, going back and forth from nights to days in different areas. And I said, heck, I can put up a body shop as long as I can keep up a normal life, you know. And I'd have to go in 4:30 in the afternoon. I mean, that there, I hated that with a passion. That wasn't my scene. But let's see. Then I went to metal finish. I did a lot of work in metal finish later on in my life. I went in. I used to run the repair wall, and then I run a lot of ding work up in paint, and a lot of Well, it was pre-ding and stuff like that was when it was outboard. And I did all that, and then also I did, like I say, the ding work, and we tried to, if there was any kind of thing, we tried so we didn't break paint. That was up in paint repair. And I worked a lot of changeovers, too.
When you hired in 76, were there many women or minorities working around you?
No, there wasn't. There was a few minorities. John Lilly was one, and so was Frank Ash. There was a couple of utility guys, I remember. And then, of course, they were spread out different places, too, you know. And it took me a little while to get to know really basically where I was at. And then I kind of, after I went on utility, then I ventured out, and then that's where I really started meeting a lot of different people. But women-wise, my wife came in before I did in 76, and she was in a batch of women that was in that pre-women's lib thing. And Body Shop didn't hire a lot of women, personally, because they had jobs that was undesirable, number one. And then number two, they had health restrictions if they were in baby years or whatever. And so General Motors and UAW probably, you know, they kept them out of there so that, you know, they didn't get sick. But she came in a batch, and I'm trying to remember what the magic number was, but there was 12 or 13 of them. And they came in, and they were in before some guys came in. And she lasted all 30 in there in the body shop. And now I've seen some odds of Delta that were in her group, and I think there's still five or six of them. So that means that there was probably seven of the original 12 or 13 that stayed 30 years in body shop. That's very, very amazing. That's really amazing. 30 years is tough for a man in body shop, let alone a woman.
So you met your wife in the plant?
Yeah. I met her. Matter of fact, she worked in underbody. So I see, out of 30 years, I bet I probably have known her for about 26. Probably 26 or 27 of the 30.
How did you meet her?
She was a line worker, and we just all talked to each other when we were in the department. It was just the way it was. It made the day go. Everybody's talking about this and that, or they're going to go fishing or hunting, and I don't know, she just was a talkative person, and so basically we just, I don't know, we'd meet. I mean, it just the way it was. When you go on a job, if she was across from me, you know, you talk to her and that type of deal.
Was it hard having romance in the plant?
I don't know if it, I don't think you call it a romance. Basically what we considered each other was co-workers. That was just the way it was. We did our gig after work. We were going to go have a drink or something after work, and that's what we did or whatever. When we hired in, it was basically hi, bye, and whatever. I'd drop her off out front, and then I'd go around and I'd go to my area, and that's the way it was. I don't remember it ever really being too tough. I was pretty busy, she was pretty busy, and she did her gig, and I did mine until after we got out.
Earlier you said that you knew just about all the jobs on the M-line and the C-line.
Yeah.
In the body shop. Was it easy for you to learn all these jobs? Was it easy for everybody to learn these jobs?
No, I can't say it was easy, but I saw a benefit to me because I can remember a couple times when I would go to get shipped out to an area, and if they were really short and had other guys coming, they knew I knew how to run relief. If that was open, then I could get it. Those type of jobs, if you could get just that extra 15, 20 minutes during the day, it was cherished. So I saw a benefit for me doing it. I don't think there was really anything easy about it. It was more or less paying attention to what was going on and willing to do it. There was guys around utility that were terrible. I mean, that was the bottom line. They were just terrible. They just existed, and management really, really worked around a lot of them guys. Some of them, they just they treated everybody different. If they called and somebody was extra, they'd ask if, say, like Tom was a good one too. They'd ask if Tom was busy or if I was busy or whatever, and then the other ones they would tell him, forget it, we'll get somebody else, because they'd already had them over there before. But that day wasn't a lot, you know. But I'm just saying. But it was a task to learn them, and it was just a process process or whatever. A lot of them kind of mirrored each other if you really thought about it, you know. And you just kind of collated them together, and the next thing you know, that's the way it was. So.
You also said earlier that you didn't spend much time on second shift. Most of your time was spent on the day shift. Are there any big differences between day shift and night shift? What are the differences?
Family, number one. It just seemed like family life really, really revolves after 4 or so or 5 at night. I mean, it just, that's just the way society is. Excuse me. I don't really know if that's as much of a case now as it was back when I was younger and trying to raise a family. And another thing was your social life or any type of anything. I mean, like, I'm really a big part of service organization now and helping stuff. There is a few clubs now, they have what they call daytime places, you know, like Breakfast Club or whatever for Lions, but it's just society run where when you got out of your shift, then things really started happening. And it's just, that's the way society was. For me, when I went in, of course, I couldn't play softball. I was a real athletic guy. And when I was on nights, I couldn't do that. All my friends that were going here and there, I was sort of... I started dating, engaged with my first wife at the time. So, of course, you know, she'd be coming home off of work and I'd be going down Michigan Avenue heading to Fisher Body. Dad, of course, didn't make me feel very good about the idea. And but then after you got in there, you know, and I don't know, you know, just it was something, you know. It was a different way of life. And then after you got on days, I mean, I don't know, you just seemed like your life balanced out and just everything went different. But there's a lot of people that just, they like nights, you know, and that was their lifestyle. It just wasn't part of my picture. I just didn't think it was something that, I never was like that. I never was a night, you know, person to work.
Do you remember, I'm sorry.
Gary, Judy, did you have any pranks pulled on you when you hired in?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the old sealer and the gloves, go answer the phone, had sealer on it, water. Somebody'd walk up behind you and throw a cigarette in your back pocket of your coveralls. Next thing you know, you'd be smelling something and then your butt was on fire. You know, because just the body shop, you know, you could catch on fire anyway. So when you smelt something like that, you know, you knew something was wrong. But you look and somebody threw a cigarette butt in your pocket, you know, while you were inside the eye welding or whatever. I mean, all in fun. I mean, I don't ever remember any pranks and really nothing that made me mad because paybacks were always hell, so, you know. But water balloons, especially when it was a hot night. People eating your lunch. I remember I had a guy always eating my lunch. He was just a big eater. I remember one time he ate my whole damn lunch and he put a $5 bill in and told me to go to Harry's and have lunch. Bought me something off the wagon. That was something else I did, too. I was growing pretty much. I used to bring 4 or 5 sandwiches a day and then still buy stuff off the wagon. That was a big thing back then, wagon. And they took that away. That was a big thing. There's a lot of people who don't even know what you're talking about when you say wagon.
Why did they take wagon away?
It was a contractual thing. It was an extra 12 minutes that the line wasn't running. So, there was a 6-minute break in the morning. And then there was a 6-minute break in the afternoon, and just that 6 minutes was something that people really looked forward to. And they run relief and everything, so, you know, that was 6 cars that they weren't building, because back in the end, you know, we were building 60 an hour, so that was 6 vehicles, you know, in the morning and 6 in the afternoon, so that was 12 vehicles they didn't get.
Can you describe what a wagon was?
Yeah, it was this... cafeteria girl or guy or whatever, he had these little carts and he used to have cans of pop on it and he had cookies and sandwiches and fresh fruit and milk or whatever, you know, you wanted. And you'd go over there and you'd pay her for whatever you had, and then you still had a little bit of time to go over and sit down and eat whatever you had. If not, you know, you could take it back over and finish it up on the line if you had another. If you were lucky enough to have a job that you could finish it up on. Those were a little bit far between back then. You just didn't have time for that. You barely had enough time to talk.
Go.
Mike, did you work any changeovers?
Yeah, as I said before, I probably worked 24 or 25 of them, and the only reason why I didn't really work all the rest of them was they stopped taking supplemental help. I worked a lot of different shifts. I worked first, worked second for a little while, kind of they got out of that, they gave you a choice, and then I worked third. I kind of got into that after a while. It took a little bit to get used to. But I first started out, I just was a maintenance helper, and you kind of bounced around down in there, and then finally they started assigning you to places. Some of the bigger ones and that, then next thing you know, you were hooked up with Millwrights, and that was where I worked with a lot. I learned how to use a torch and how to do a lot of arc weld, and of course I knew how to MIG weld already from body shop, so kind of the relationship was pretty much the same, except for one uses a wire and the other uses a what they call an arc rod and a stick weld. And learned a lot of things in there. Got to the point where I just knew just about every square inch of the plant. Worked up in paint, pulled chain before, built platforms, Hollywood rail, which is was what the air hoses hung on and slid on throughout the plant. Put up a highway rail, which was the orange safety rail that went all through the whole plant if some of it was broke. Just anything that Millwrights do. It was basically, I was kind of like a maintenance helper. And then eventually they didn't need anybody at Millwrights, and they knew I liked to work, so then they put me in the pipe shop for a while. And I learned how to use a rigid machine. That's what threads the pipe and hang pipe and put new fire line in. I did a lot of that. That type of stuff. I mean, it gave me an opportunity. I learned a lot. I use a lot of it on today on the outside. With the training, you know, that I got from the UAW people and GM, you know, the opportunity, man, I'll tell you, it was there if you really wanted to do it. I enjoy it too because it got me a chance to meet a lot of different people in the business. It was real interesting. Built line. I built tracks before. Pulling chain, that was a different experience there. That was real dirty and hot, but it was, you know, it was part of the business. That's what you had to do. Chain wore out, and you had to replace it. But that was a whole another atmosphere. Plus, two kind of helped me pay bills after I got a divorce. You know, kind of helped me pay my support and keep things going. And it was just easier for me to do that. And I had the opportunity, so I did it.
So did you meet any, what was your relationship with skilled trades employees?
Matter of fact, to this day right now, one of my best friends I went and fished with was a Millwright. He came out of the Livonia plant. And in his plant, they didn't weld. They knew how to read blueprints, and they knew how to shim motors and stuff. But they had what they called a maintenance welder, and we used to have that. And I worked underneath one of them one time when we retooled from Cutlasses and 98s and 88s to go to our front-wheel drive car there. I think it was called the X-Car or whatever it was. That Grand Am and that when we went to that. But I met him, it was about 10 years ago. And we was on third shift, and a boss in there, his name was Paul Urich, and he was a Millwright boss. Said, Mike, meet Mike. Mike knows how to read blueprints. He's a skilled trades. And Mike, he's a production maintenance helper, and he knows how to weld. And next thing you know, to this day, he lives in Pinckney, and we got a cabin up north, and we hunt and fish together, and have a really good relationship. I would say, like, one of my best buds. And Then, of course, too, you know, I got a ton of them that are still in there that I know if I need something or if I, you know, whatever. But my whole maintenance experience was good. I don't remember anything bad about it. I mean, there was some jobs that you didn't like, and of course, there was certain bosses, you know, that had a different style, you know. Some of them called them bird dogs, and some of them would assign you a job, and as long as you got that job done, you know, then there wasn't any, you didn't have to hear from them anymore. But most of my experience in maintenance was really good. I had a lot of fun doing it, and learned a lot of different things.
So do you feel that if you hadn't worked the changeovers and met the maintenance people, would it have been harder to have done your own job? Were they a lot of help in, lockers or things that you needed as a body shop employee?
Yeah, especially after when we got into employee involvement, that helped me tremendously. That took a lot of red tape out because you used to have to fill out a ton of work orders. And these guys that I got to know, if it wasn't really too big a job, and if I needed something, I used to just go up to them and I'd tell them, I'd say, hey, Jim, or Mike, or Dave, or Scrubby, or whoever it was, you know, and they'd, sure, Mike, I get a chance, you know, I'll make that up for you, or I'll go move this fan a little bit, you know, maybe it got bumped by a finger truck or something, you know, it just was just that inside track that you needed to get through the bureaucracy that was inside of the plant, you know. And it was really interesting. And it really actually got to the point where there was a lot of people knew that I knew people like that. So they came to me and said, hey, Mike, you think maybe you could get somebody to help me do this or whatever? And I don't think I ever got turned down by them. You know, they would tell me if they were too busy and if they didn't get it done in a couple of days, remind them. And I didn't have to remind them very often. They went and got it done for me. So, but that was a good experience. That was a real good experience.
So let's talk about supervisors now. Do you have a favorite supervisor, least favorite? How did supervisory techniques change from when you hired in to when you closed the plant?
I had an opportunity to talk to quite a few people. I used to work for my dad when he was one. And I don't know. I guess I only worked for him for a couple of times when he was a boss. But I like people that were people for people. You know, they didn't come in just to please their boss, I guess. And you could tell those people really easy. The hard nose. There was some of them. There was quite a few of them. It was their way, and that's just the way it was. So when you went to work for them, you pretty much knew how to handle yourself or whatever. You knew what you had to do. But then there was some that communicate with you. You'd stand there, and they'd like to talk to you. They pretty much cared about you. And I think that's really what makes a supervisor probably more successful than the other guy, is if you really kind of take care of your troops and they like you, I think they'd probably do you a lot better job than if somebody was kind of rubbing her thumb down on you all the time. Maybe you thought that they breathed better air than you or whatever. But I worked for an awful lot of supervisors, and I don't know, I had an awful lot of good ones. I don't know if I could ever pinpoint one person, but I did have one, and I got to tell you this. And this guy, his name was Bill Remersnyder, and that man, he worked in underbody, and he's the only boss. I used to get my check handed to me before I went on and got a payroll deduct, you know, where they put it in the bank for you. He'd hand you your check on Friday, and you'd tell him thank you, and he'd stop you right there, and he'd say, no, thank you. Thank you for the job that you did for me and that you're doing for me. That's really the only boss that I ever knew that took time personally to tell me that. Most of the other ones, a few times they'd say okay, you know, or someone would appreciate a job for you or whatever, and they'd say thanks for helping me or whatever. But most of them, if you ever went to their area, you'd work for them the whole day, and you know, I don't know. Some of them would just leave you alone or whatever. None of them would, you know, come over and acknowledge you or whatever. But Worked for a lot of different ones. I think the most successful ones, though, that were liked were people. You know, that liked people and liked to talk to people and communicate to people. The ones that were not liked very much were the old school guys. They were pretty tough to work for. They were pretty tough to work for.
What about jobs? Do you have a best and a least favorite job?
Let's see. Utility was a favorite of mine for a long time. And that was just simple because I didn't have to go in and do the same thing every day. When I became a part of employee involvement, I really got to see a different side of the business and trying to get people involved in the aspects of work. That was fun until it started getting pretty stressful. A lot of things was mistaken, I guess. I don't know. I liked my my relief job. That was a people-pleasing job, and all you had to do was just go a little extra. And the time went by pretty good there, you know, ringing around and giving people relief. And then when they run mass relief and stop the line, then I had to move on to something. I had to go back in utility, and I was getting old, and I didn't like that anymore because I was getting too beat up, arthritis. I don't know, carpal tunnels and tendonitis and stuff like that, you know, started creeping up on me. And I said, man, I got to do something different than that. And I got into what they used to call a team coordinator. Now it's called a team leader. And there's some good opportunities in that. But it all depends on your people. It all depends on your people. If you have a really, really good group, that'll make it a lot easier for you. But as far as my favorite, I probably have to say relief. I really enjoyed that. That was probably about one of my best jobs I ever had in there. Besides working changeovers, I mean, I like millwright work. I really like that. I should have had a career in it, but I'm not going to go into that.
Can you tell us a little bit about department dinners and department activities? Did you get involved in any of that?
A ton of them. Back years ago, there was not a Thanksgiving or Christmas went by that we didn't have a department dinner. And now they were all homemade. Everybody's wife or significant other or whatever would bring in something, and everybody would share the gig. And if you had a really good boss, they would do something for you on the holiday. Some of them didn't. Sometimes they'd buy the meat, and some of them would give you a gift. It kind of went away a little bit for a while. But then there were some departments I was in, like in metal finish, it seemed like about every week we had something. You know, we had a lunch or a breakfast of some sort. And most of the times it was on a Friday. And it was a good get-together for everybody. Depending on the season, too, we'd make if it was corn was coming, and we'd, you know, get, well, a bunch of farmers worked in there, too, you know, so they'd bring in sweet corn, and somebody'd say, okay, well, how about having BLTs with it, so boom, you know, somebody had a bunch of tomatoes in their garden, and it was just them type of deals, but like I say, it was about every, unless somebody, too, had a birthday, every once in a while, there'd be a birthday party, but most generally, it was around the holiday. Every Thanksgiving and Christmas.
How about bowling leagues or softball tournaments?
Okay, I was in a bowling league I started out in 76 because I can remember it. If you rolled a 200, they gave you a red, white, and blue patch. And I was on that league, and that was, of course, I was on night shift then. And I lasted through probably about four different years of bowling, but bowling got to the point where it was so long. It was a terribly, terribly long season. That was sponsored by the UAW. And then I got out of that, and then I started into the golf league. And I played on the UAW golf league for probably about 18 years. And we bounced around different courses and stuff. That was a really good time. And then softball. To this day, I was part of through employee participation, was what we called it, was EPG. We run a 65-team double elimination tournament, and we did it all in one day. And to my knowledge, I don't think there's another one bigger that's been in one day. in Michigan. A lot of the umpires had told me that umpire dad. And that was for Area 8 Special Olympics. And that, man, we made a ton of money that day. But we got fields, let's see, we got fields from Delta Township. We got fields from Waverly High School. We had a couple here in the city. And we had just about every softball diamond you could think of ate up. And that was a double elimination. That was all people from the shop. They had all different kinds of names, and it was fun. And that softball, that's about as far as I got into that in there. There was some leagues when I was a conservation and rec chair. I remember some teams that come and got entry fees and stuff, and they used to run leagues. But not as much as when they were younger. The workforce started getting older, and things just wasn't the same. They didn't play ball like they did back when they were young and stuff. But that's about the recreation. There was there used to be bow shoots and stuff like that, but those are pretty much done on the outside, you know, and if they need a low support, whatever, for targets or something like that, they used to come to recreation. But that was the events that I was involved in with the union, and as far as recreation.
Were those events mainly for charity?
The EPG one was. All the other events that we had, as far as the golf league and the bowling, there was a kitty for that, and the money went into that, went into the year-end bankrupt. Now, if there was money left over, it would go to some, you know, I can't remember all for sure, because that was quite a few years ago, but I can't remember some going to Crystal Ray and some money going here or there, food bank or something like that when it first started and stuff. Most of the other ones were kind of, they had a kitty, and it just all the extra money went in for the year-end banquet.
Mike, as we close this interview, is there anything that I've not asked you that you'd like to talk about?
No, not really. Just being a third generation, having the opportunity to work there, I guess, see what it did for, you know, my grandpa and my dad, and then, I can't believe 30 years went by as fast as it did, because I can remember, just seemed like a little while ago, was I couldn't believe I had like 20 years, you know, and I had about 10 more to go. And I remember I had this boss, and she was a really good one too. Her name was Barb Milan, and she gave me my 25-year award, and she goes, the next thing you know, she goes, you're going to have 30. You know, and really that only seems like a few days ago. And I've seen the place go a lot of different, you know, it changed a lot from, I don't know, it was just, there was no involvement part. What it was, you were just a number. They gave you a hammer and you know, some gloves and a pair of coveralls and stuff down by the shop and told you to go to work. Now, in this business that we're in nowadays, they kind of ask about you, you know, they ask you your opinion and stuff, so that's changed a lot.
So you think there's definitely a lot more employee involvement?
And it's an unmeasurable thing. And how I say that is because it used to be measured by how many people came to a meeting back when I was in EPG, employee involvement. And that number, by somebody coming to a lunchtime meeting, didn't have any indication at all about how much involved the person was. I mean, because, you know, if you had 8 guys or 9 guys in here, just because they didn't choose to come and sit with you at lunchtime didn't mean they weren't involved. And I had some really, really good people that just didn't give up their lunch hour. They didn't believe in it. But that didn't mean that they didn't care about what they were doing, because after they come back, they always want to know what you talked about or whatever. So, but now, I think business has changed dramatically compared to what it used to be before. You pretty much had to run everything by your boss. And now there's a lot more experience, too. This workforce is a lot more experienced. And also, they just, they're more involved than what it used to be. You know, as far as outgoing involvement, they can see.
Now I'm going to take a moment to ask the other team members if they have any questions for Mike.
Yeah, Mike, this is Earl Nicholson. I know you've been involved in the union quite a bit. Could you list all of your union activities, your appointments, and so forth?
Yeah. That was another good opportunity, you know, and I'm surprised that I didn't say anything about that because I'm awful UAW-oriented, and anybody that knows me, I'm really pro-American, and I really dislike foreign cars. That's probably my big pet peeve. I had the opportunity, one of the utility guys I knew, too, in a relationship that I didn't mention previously to this, that I met, and I used to do a lot of hunting fishing with the guy from a production level, not from the maintenance level, it was Frank Stone. He got me the very first opportunity and experience to learn what the United Auto Workers meant and what it did. And I got I started out, I was an alternate, then I was elected alternate. And I can't remember exactly what year that was in. But I also had an opportunity because he runs zone quite a bit. So that meant that you were inactive, you know, a lot more than what a usual, you know, alternate would do. So that meant I really kind of got my feet wet in the grievance procedure process and, you know, the civil rights aspect of it and the whole deal, you know, and the contract language and that type of deal. So I got into that, and then, of course, I went to committee school, and then I was a committee man for a while, and then I ran, and I was an employee participation advisor. I kind of thought, well, I mean, I'd like to do something else, because I always kind of like to be involved in stuff. So I run for conservation and recreation. And I always was, like I said, an outdoor person, and a hunting person, and a fishing person and that type of thing, and I really liked outdoors and I liked sports. I said to myself, man, that sounds like something cool. So I ran for that, and I got elected to that. And I served one term in that, so I got to see the executive board position and the leadership of the local union. And so I really, actually, as far as covering some of the aspects of the union, I covered pretty much of them, you know, the alternate, and then that was an appointed job. Actually, I said before that I didn't have an appointment, but that's by the committee person, you know. They talk and they pick somebody, usually probably between the committee and the alternate, to make that. And then the alternate position got my feet wet pretty good into it, and then I was a district for a term. And then I was also one term on the executive board. And I think that gave me... I also went to Black Lake. I had an opportunity to do that. That was a very, very beautiful experience. I went up on a ConCon convention for conservation and rec. Met a lot of people from all of the United States. I have nothing but a positive for that. And everybody has an opportunity to do that. Not everybody wants to do that. Or, you know, and some like to criticize people for doing it, but it sure gave me a different side of the business. Different side of the bed.
So tell me, community activities, right now actively, what type of activities are you involved in for community outside of the UAW, or outside of the factory?
I have about five of them that I'm real active in. Number one, I guess it'll go right along with being in conservation. I'm a Michigan United Conservation Club member. That goes right along with my Oldsmobile Outdoor Club. That was a club that was founded some 55 years, I think it is now, over in Oldsmobile. And now it's called GM of Lansing Oldsmobile Outdoor Club. That Oldsmobile name's still got a lot of personal value to a lot of people that built Oldsmobiles for years. But we named it, now we just added GM UAW Employees of Lansing's Outdoor Club. I've been a member of that for 22 years. I was the very first person invited, a group from Fisher Body, when they came over and wanted to expand their roots a little bit, make the club a little bit bigger. And I'm currently sitting on the executive board on that. I'm the only 602 member that's sits on that. I am co-secretary. And that club right there, for what it offers for little money, I just can't believe it. More people don't take advantage of it. But today's world, I mean, at one time, the Fisher Body had more people than Olsenville, and they kind of got scared for them. They couldn't believe it. But it was a trend. And a lot of those people that are outdoor people were kind of a little bit older people, and then they ended up falling and retiring. They're still members, but they're at kind of like what we would call them at large. You know, we just give them a lifetime membership. So then I'm in Lions Club. I've been in Lions Club for 25 years. It's a Brenton Woods Club, small little club over here in Delta Township. My dad invited me into that. Do a ton of activities on that. I take that back. I am an executive board member of that too. I'm a co-treasurer because the guy's gonna move, and I filled every position of that. I was the president all the way down, and I love doing that. And I'm also a hunter safety instructor, so I work with the DNR. And then also right now too, I got the opportunity to work with Fasper Softball at Wavy High School. And I'm having a really good time. I'm in my fourth year doing that. So I stay pretty active.
Go.
Mike, could you tell us, do you have a happiest moment or a saddest moment in the plant?
Yeah, I got both. The happiest one probably be when I got my 25-year watch, because my grandpa had one and my dad had one, so I could put three of them together and say that's 75 years. Of service. And the saddest part kind of is a twofold. Probably when Fisher Body symbol came down off the wall and we had to start being called about 40 different names, and then when the place closed. It never really sunk until the very last day when I walked out of there that I was never going to go back in there. I was going in and out of there, my grandpa was in and out of there, my dad was in and out of there, and then all of a sudden when I walked out that last day, I kept turning around and just kind of glimpsing things that I would never see again, and saying goodbye to some people that I'd never worked for and never worked with again. That was a big, big low, and it took a while. For me to get over that. The Fisher Body thing, that's a sad thing, but that'll never go away from me. I have a lot of Fisher Body memorabilia, you know, with my grandpa, my dad, and that. So those probably about the best and the saddest. Just leaving that place, you know, it was pretty tough.
And how did you feel about the name changes when it went from Fisher Body to BOP to BOC to LCA?
Yes, never knew. But, you know, when you went and somebody asked you where you worked and you just told them Fisher Body, they knew. They didn't go by the old symbol. They didn't go by Lansing Automotive Division. They didn't go by BOC, you know. So they didn't go by Lansing Car Assembly. Oh, Fisher Body, okay. And they would write Fisher Body down. And I said, that makes me happy, because that's what it still is to me today. And that coach not being on the car, man, that was a big deal, man. That was really a big deal. A lot of people look for that on the rocker. And so, to me, it still is. I'm you know, one of them. I'm the third one, so I still call it that no matter what.
Well, Mike, I really appreciate you taking time out to talk to us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
You're welcome.